Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
And now, three Christian peace activists held captive for nearly 4 months in Iraq are safe after U.S. and British troops freed them this morning without firing a single shot. Canadians 41-year-old James Loney, 32-year-old Harmeet Singh Sudan, and 74-year-old Briton Norman Kember were working in Iraq with the group Christian Peacemaker Teams. Details about their release are still unfolding and sometimes changing from earlier reports. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Amr Madhani, who writes for the Chicago Tribune in Baghdad. And Amr, we understand that the Briton is now in the green zone and that the two Canadians are in the hospital, but what more have you found out about how they're doing?
The U.S. military just had a press conference not too long ago, and they're reporting that all are in pretty good health, that they don't seem like they were badly abused as far as they can tell from sort of the initial examinations they gave to him, and they said they were in pretty good spirits as well.
Well, we heard reports earlier this morning that the military found two men who led them to the place where the hostages were held. What more are Americans saying about what happened?
Well, the Brits, Jack Straw in London, first announced that the hostages had been found, and he made it seem like this was sort of the culmination of weeks and weeks of efforts. And from what the Americans were saying, it was almost as if they sort of stumbled upon the Christian Peacemaker Team. Essentially, they said that they had grabbed two guys yesterday in some unrelated operation. During interrogation, one of these two guys that they grabbed told them that the hostages were at this house in West Baghdad, and essentially 3 hours after they got this information, they barged into this house and found the three of them bound, just sitting in a room in the house together, but no kidnappers or any suspects in the area.
And it does remind us, do we know anything more about the efforts underway to free kidnapped American journalist Jill Carroll?
There is no news. That question was put forward to Major General Rick Lynch, the spokesman for the multinational forces today. And they said that their efforts are ongoing, but he did not offer any new information today.
Well, I'm returning to the broader scene there in Baghdad and in Iraq. U.S. military forces sent in extra troops in advance of last week's religious observance, and yet we read that 17 religious pilgrims were killed in Karbala this week. But is there a sense of, you know, how well the 2 weeks went?
Well, you know, I think this last 2 weeks, there wasn't sort of the spectacular attack in Karbala that there's been in past years. But, you know, the sectarian tensions are extremely high. In the last week, there was 134 bodies dumped in various places throughout Baghdad. Today, there's three bombings in Baghdad that killed 33 people. What's sort of changing, though, in the last few months, used to be the insurgency looked like they were targeting security forces. In the last week, 65% of the people that were killed were just innocent men, women, and children, civilians. These were just people going about their lives that were essentially killed because of their sect.
Well, Amr, do you have any sense that Iraqis are at all paying attention to President Bush's 5-day campaign here in the States to convince the American people that things are going better than they think in Iraq? I mean, we know there are satellite televisions all over Baghdad and Iraq. Are Iraqis aware of this, and do they have an opinion about it?
You know, absolutely they are. You know, I think I've been traveling in and out of Iraq for 3 years now, and I think that attitudes and are at all-time low, and people that were optimistic and would hang on to optimism even at the height of the insurgency are now finding their optimism waning and sort of hitting this rock bottom. And it's a hard time. You know, people don't see any end to this. And, you know, there's a sense what the president says and what the military commanders here on the ground say is that the end of the sectarian violence will be nipped in the bud by there being a forming of a national unity government. People are watching it here, and, you know, I don't think they buy it.
Amr Madhani, he reports for the Chicago Tribune from Baghdad. The execution of inmate Michael Morales in California is scheduled for May, postponed from earlier this year after two physicians refused to take part in the injection procedure. California law requires that an anesthesiologist supervise lethal injections. Several states require some sort of doctor be present at lethal injections. But the California Medical Association opposes such participation, as does the American Medical Association, which states that the only thing physicians can do to an inmate at execution is provide a death certificate, and this only after someone else has declared the inmate dead. All of which sets up a fascinating stalemate between doctors and states, and in some cases, between doctors. Atul Gawande is a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston. He's also a staff writer for The New Yorker. And he wondered, just who are the doctors who do participate in lethal injections, and why do they do it? Well, they usually keep their identity secret, but he did find four who were willing to talk. He writes about what they told him in this week's New England Journal of Medicine and joins us now to tell us more. Welcome, Dr. Gawande.
Thank you for having me.
And first, let's tell people a little bit about you, because you're reporting comes through the prism of you. Going into this research project, what was your stand on the death penalty?
Part of the reason I was interested in this was because I am someone who was a senior official in the Clinton administration in 1992 and 93, and I defended President Clinton's stance in favor of the death penalty. I do think that for some people, the death penalty is appropriate, and certainly in the case of Timothy McVeigh, the case of Saddam Hussein. But then on the flip side, I've always thought that it's inappropriate for doctors and nurses to be involved in executions. In fact, I've thought it was flat out wrong.
Because, as you say, participation is medicine as an instrument of punishment.
That's right. That people give us this incredible opportunity and privilege of doing what would normally be considered assault in any other circumstance, opening people up, giving them drugs, even making them unconscious. And they do it because we are doing it on their behalf, not on behalf of the government or other powers against them.
But as you write, you had at least that second belief rattled quite a bit as you did this research. We won't say what your final conclusion was just yet, but also give us some context as to lethal injections. They became legal because, as you write, they seemed the least harmful to the inmate.
That's right. In other words, where we've come down, and this is where it became a kind of personal conflict for me as well, is that in order to execute somebody, we have moved away from hangings, from firing squads. The very first execution after the Supreme Court made it legal again in the 1970s was with Gary Gilmore. And he had four bullets in his heart, and his heart continued to beat for 2 minutes after the shooting. We tried electrocutions as the most common thing that was attempted, and prisoners were set on fire. And then came along lethal injection. The protocol was actually invented by an anesthesiologist at the University of Oklahoma in the 1970s, and the states all rapidly adopted lethal injections. It had the potential for being much more pain-free compared to other forms of execution.
Well, you say potential, but prison technicians had problems administering the drugs. They really couldn't do it. They needed doctors, but the American Medical Association passed a resolution against physicians participating. Now, did they outright ban this?
Yeah, it is complicated. In a way, you have to understand how the injections are done. You would think this is really simple. You give three drugs and they're dead. But in fact, it's hard. Putting in intravenous lines sometimes can be very hard to find an IV access, especially if someone is very large or they're a drug user and don't have veins. And then there's the timing of the medicines. Part of the reason the courts in California stopped the executions there was they found out that giving one drug right after the other, the prisoner would still be breathing. And so having medical supervision makes it possible. And that's precisely why the American Medical Association, indeed medical associations all around the world, have been very loath to be at all involved in executions.
Well, for fear that they might be called on to participate more. How were individual physicians allowed to participate by the AMA?
They gave two little windows. One is that a physician can certify death, meaning sign a death certificate, but they did not want their presence in the execution chamber or around the activities. The second was to provide medications before the execution at the request of the prisoner if they wanted something to calm their anxiety.
Now, you spoke with four doctors, and all of them had different feelings, but one, for instance, sort of, you know, really didn't understand what he was getting into. He said to a friend that he would come help out in the local prison because the friend who worked at the prison was his patient. But then before he knew it, he was being asked to help. I mean, tell us about that slope.
Yeah, it's very interesting. For the physicians and one nurse also I spoke to who were involved in what turned out to be more than 45 executions among these five people. Most of them, if they weren't employees of the state, they were drawn in by a patient. The doctor was asked if he would come to a blood pressure clinic. Well, started going to the blood pressure clinic and then said, well, will you help us with this one other problem? And what they said was, you know, all we need is someone just to pronounce death. And the first execution went just like that. Everything went smoothly and he pronounced the death. But then in the next three executions, there were problems because they couldn't get the IV. The technician would stick and stick and stick and couldn't get the IV in. And then they turn to the doctor and they say, boy, you know something about this. Can you help out? He said, sure.
And this doctor that we're talking about, Dr. A, I think you called him?
I did, Dr. A.
He didn't even know that his own organization, the AMA, prohibited him from being involved.
Yeah, and there was a survey in 1999 showing that only 3% of physicians knew that participating in an execution violated ethical principles as set out by the AMA.
And then you come across Physician D. He has since allowed his name to be used. Carlo Musso?
That's right. He is a 45-year-old emergency physician. He is a volunteer who helps in a child abuse shelter, and he's against the death penalty. And he has also participated in six executions so far in Georgia.
We have a clip of an interview that Dr. D. Carlo Musso did with the New England Journal of Medicine, and he talks about how he wanted to see an execution before he participated. He wanted to know what it would be like. Let's listen.
I can tell you I had several emotions. One was it was incredibly sad. There was a level of anxiety and tension in the room which was palpable. However, I pondered this issue for quite some time, and I had a stark realization that this was indeed an end-of-life issue. I sat in that chair in the observation area, and I could stare at the gurney and at the electric chair from one vantage point in the room. And that was the visual fixation that kept repeating in my head over and over again. And at that point, I felt that it was my duty to make sure if someone were going to die, that he die or she die in the most humane way possible.
What about that thinking, that this isn't as much ending a life as it is helping in the end of life?
Well, there is something compelling to that argument. He's saying, I don't want this person to die. The state, the government, is going to kill this person no matter what I do. So maybe I should be there to help make sure that they have as little suffering as possible in that process.
Dr. Atul Gawande, who might have changed his mind after hearing from Dr. D on physicians present at executions, we'll find out. But we do know long-held beliefs from Dr. Gawande were shattered. More coming up here and now. And we're back with Dr. Atul Gawande, a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston, whose article about physicians who perform lethal injections on death row inmates appears in this week's New England Journal of Medicine. We just heard from one of those physicians, Carlo Musso of Georgia, who told the journal that he's against the death penalty but thinks it's important for him to assist to make sure that patients get the most humane possible end-of-life care. Dr. Gawande, you didn't believe that doctors should be at executions, but did Carlo Musso's arguments rattle you a little?
That's powerful, but I think it's still wrong. And that's the final conclusion I came to. And it's because of a couple reasons. One is that it's not at all clear this person is his patient. He has no control over the protocol. The person doesn't get to choose whether he wants this doctor or not, let alone whether he wants this so-called treatment or not. The doctor is anonymous to the person and their family. They don't have to reveal their identity. They don't have to take responsibility for how well or poorly it goes. And then the second part of it is, in the end, the hand that is more gently putting in the IV, more soothingly pushing that potassium bolus, is also the hand that kills the patient.
But that brings us to the next part, which is you had your thinking rattled about whether or not you think doctors should be involved in lethal injections. You come to the conclusion that they shouldn't be, which puts them on the sidelines again. But Dr. D had some thoughts about that. He says that just pronouncing death and standing in the room in the pronouncing death really is no different than having a hands-on involvement. Let's listen.
Once I've decided to participate, I'm going to participate in the process. Whether it's just pronouncing death or giving some indirect assistance, the healthcare group as a whole, I consider as one entity, if you will. The healthcare group and members involved in this process is indistinguishable from what role I play and what role he plays or she plays.
So I guess the question, Dr. Gwande, is if you agree with him on that point, then doctors shouldn't be in the room at all, and then where are we on lethal injections and the death penalty?
I think he is right. Once a physician takes a role of supervision in any way, then we are providing the means and ability to execute somebody. I've talked about the reasons why in the end that's not good for physicians or nurses to do. And that's where the conflict comes in, because you now have 17 states that mandate that a physician be there. And the remainder of the states strongly encourage that a physician be there and protects the physician's license so they can't be challenged in order to be there. What the California court recognized is that it really takes high levels of expertise to know when someone is actually unconscious and can be free enough from pain that the next medications can be given. And they wanted not only a doctor but specifically an anesthesiologist to be doing it. So when we step back, what we have then is a collision between what the law wants and what the ethical principles of being a physician involve. And where I come down is that one has to give. And in the end, we cannot afford as a society for the core principles of doctoring to be what gives. If we had to choose between a society that could not execute some murderers and one that can execute them but has to do it by violating core principles of what doctors and nurses ought to be doing, I think our best choice then is clearly to not violate those basic principles of medicine.
But what does that mean about your stance on the death penalty?
Well, it does leave the quandary that I am someone who thought all the way along that certain people do deserve to die when they've done enough evil as murderers. But I'm far more disturbed by the possibility that physicians and nurses would have to violate their basic principles of practice to do it than I am that those people might not be executed. I think we'll be better off as a society if, yes, some of those people do deserve to die, but instead they will end up with life in prison because we consider it more important that we have a medical establishment that protects people.
And your concluding line, if it turns out that executions can't be performed without, as the courts put it, unconstitutional pain and cruelty, which, as we were just saying, would probably happen at least a quarter of the time if doctors weren't in the room, the death penalty should be abolished.
That's right.
Were you surprised?
Well, I really struggled over exactly how, you know, for a while one of the thoughts I had is that maybe what we need are execution teams, people who would be trained to, you know, not physicians, you know, maybe it would be from veterinary medicine, who would come in and put people to sleep for this purpose. The trouble is, number one, these are people who could not maintain their practice, could not know how to do this very well, unless they actually were practicing on human beings. So it would be like having people come through medical schools for the purpose of executing people, and that would simply be unacceptable. And I think in the country as a whole, there is a substantial minority of people who oppose the death penalty, but the majority support the death penalty. The majority also do not want to have their doctors and nurses as executioners. And in the end, one has to give. And where I came down, it seemed actually relatively clear by the end, was that what should be set aside is not the ethics of medicine, but the death penalty itself.
Atul Gawande, he's a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston. His article about lethal injections by physicians is in this week's New England Journal of Medicine. Again, he came to the conclusion that doctors should not attend lethal injections, therefore the death penalty cannot be carried out humanely and should be abolished. Meanwhile, we leave you with the words of Dr. Carlo Musso on his decision to continue helping as long as executions exist.
I know others disagree with my position. However, I strongly feel that this is an end-of-life issue, and my duty to care for a patient in a humane way and to address the pain and suffering at death far outweighs any other of my personal ethical or moral choices.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from
Now. Tomorrow, Pope Benedict XVI will preside over ceremonies elevating 15 men to cardinal. Among them are Archbishop Sean O'Malley of Boston and William Levada, who used to head up the Archdiocese in San Francisco. Both men have found themselves in the center of a debate about whether Catholic social service agencies in the U.S. should place children awaiting adoption with gay or lesbian couples. Levada, who is now in a prominent position at the Vatican, recently said Catholic agencies should not place children for adoption in homosexual households. The Board of Supervisors in San Francisco responded this week by passing a resolution that urged Catholic leaders to defy the Vatican over this issue. While the issue simmers in San Francisco, it has exploded in Boston. In the past 20 years, Catholic Charities here in Boston has placed 13 children with gay adoptive parents. Earlier this month, after pressure from Bishop O'Malley, the agency said it would end the practice. But this put the charity in violation of anti-discrimination laws in Massachusetts. As a result, Catholic Charities canceled its entire adoption service. Well, this news comes as a disappointment to many families, but especially to those gay couples who adopted children through Catholic Charities. Here now is Monica Brady-Meyeroff profiles one of those families.
Some grandmas live with their grandpa. Some grandmas live with their friends.
We decided that that's Marge.
Oh,
the cane.
6-year-old Tatiana is in her navy blue school uniform reading a book out loud at the kitchen table in a town north of Boston. Her brother Stephen is separating his pills into containers. He's on medication for post-traumatic stress disorder from childhood trauma, attention deficit disorder, and hyperactivity.
It's 30 in here.
It's almost time for school, but Tatiana and Stephen's adoptive mothers, Linda and Karen, take a break from the morning routine. They talk about how they adopted Tatiana through the Department of Social Services. And a year later, Karen says, they found out through Catholic Charities that she had a half-brother.
It's not like we set out to, okay, we're going to adopt a child from Catholic Charities so that we can make waves and we can whatever. That wasn't in our thinking. You know, we adopted Tati's brother, her half-brother, is through Catholic Charities, and we have the opportunity for them to be together. And how beautiful is that, that they are siblings and they can be together.
Stephen is now 13, a tall, skinny boy with a little dark fuzz on his upper lip. 3 years ago, he was living in a foster home with a single mother in Mattapan. He had reached the age considered old for adoption, 10. His foster mother wasn't ready to adopt him. Because of his age and mood issues, the Department of Social Services placed him with Catholic Charities, since the social service agency had an expertise in placing children with special needs. It was also known for reuniting siblings. Karen says social workers at Catholic Charities treated her fairly.
They never questioned our ability, ever. They were supportive. They did everything that they could to offer us support along the way, as long as post-adoption work. And they went the extra mile to really make sure that we could find Stephen. And if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't have.
Karen and Linda, who have asked not to use their last names to protect their privacy, decided to adopt Stephen after visiting him in his foster home a few times.
The day that we told him that we wanted him to be part of our family, we actually had a keychain made and we engraved all our names on it.
I'll never forget that day, too, because we were so... I forget what he had done, but it was like, you know, a normal, like, kid thing that he had done something wrong. He was frustrated with us and everything because, you know, we had disciplined him. And then we said, let's do it now. So we called him and he's like all, you know, mad. And we said, we have something that we have to give you. So we just handed it to him. It has everybody's name. And then it has the keys. We said, we want you to be part of our family. We want to adopt you. And he just, I get chills just thinking of his little face just lit right up. It was so beautiful. He was so excited. I think he thought for sure that because he had done something bad, like, forget it, we're not going to want him.
Steven's got the keychain.
He does?
Mm-hmm. Well, it has Linda, Karen, mine, my sister's name on it.
Do you remember how you felt when they gave you that?
Well, I was surprised because I didn't expect it.
Now, 3 years later, the family is frustrated and angry that Catholic Charities, the agency that helped to create their family, has opted to end its adoption work rather than assist gay families. Linda, who works with children as a social worker, says the rejection stings.
It's as if a whole segment of the population of the country and maybe the world are telling me personally that I'm not fit to be a parent, when I know that every day my whole life is about being a parent.
The Vatican says that allowing children to be adopted by same-sex couples subjects them to moral violence. Catholic Charities board members decided it couldn't reconcile church teachings and the state's anti-discrimination laws. Linda and Karen say they're pleased 8 members of the Catholic Charities board resigned in protest to the bishop's attempt to seek an exemption to the anti-discrimination law. Linda says Governor Mitt Romney's legislation seeking an exemption now is wrong.
I don't think that Romney's going to be successful in having that exemption passed. And I think if he did that, we'd be taking about a 50, 60, 70, 80-year turn backwards in time, and it would really open the door for all kinds of discrimination.
Linda, who was raised Catholic but doesn't practice, says she and Karen believe and teach their children that the world changes one person at a time.
I actually called Catholic Charities yesterday, and I spoke to our adoption worker, and I called to thank her for the work that she did for our family and to let her know that everybody's doing okay right here. In our home.
The home is like any other with school children, a little chaos before heading out for school.
Okay, time to get your shoes on. Get going.
And socks.
And socks.
Where are your shoes?
Linda says after talking with her adoption worker, she takes comfort in knowing that not everyone at Catholic Charities condemns gay families.
I told her about this interview and she said, well, you know, Linda, it's not going to change Catholic Charities' decision. But if you could please let people know that the staff at Catholic Charities are not in support of this decision and that they're as upset as the rest of us about what's happening, that they believe in us and they believe in families first, regardless of their sexual preference.
With that, Linda and Karen say it's time for their kids to go to school, but not before Stephen adds his thoughts.
Makes me feel like it's unfair to gay people because like they're not really doing anything wrong.
Catholic Charities declined to be interviewed for this story, citing adoption confidentiality. They have said in the past that they've sought to place the welfare of children, like Stephen, at the heart of their work.
That report from Here Now's Monica Brady-Meyerhoff. And this further note from the Vatican. Pope Benedict XVI convened the College of Cardinals today for the first time in his tenure as Pope. At the closed-door session, the Pope discussed reconciliation with an ultra-conservative group founded by Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre. Lefebvre opposes many of the reforms that resulted from the Second Vatican Council. He was excommunicated in 1988. Pope Benedict has made it clear he wants relations with the group to be normalized. Well, still to come, we'll profile one of the stars of the new film, Thank You for Smoking. He plays such a terrific creep. You're listening to Here and Now. The Centers for Disease Control list water fluoridation as one of the 10 great public health advances of the 20th century. But a new report says federal limits on the amount of fluoride in water are not protecting the public from problems such as tooth decay and bone damage. Well, Here Now's Alan Cockle is here to explain it all to us. And Alan, first of all, for those who haven't paid any attention to this, the U.S. started adding fluoride to water in the hopes that it would help with problems.
And it does. It really was a great public health advance in the sense that putting a low level of concentration of fluoride into the water where there is none dramatically reduced the number of cavities in people. So the low level of one part per million, which is the CDC recommendation, no one is saying that's unsafe. There's a second level, though, a second number that's important, which is the EPA standard, which is a maximum level to prevent toxicity. That level's four parts per million. That's what a National Research Council committee looked at this week and said, that's got to come down. Here's the chair of that committee, Professor John Duell.
Ongoing exposure to water fluoride at levels of four parts per million puts children at risk of developing severe enamel fluorosis.
Severe enamel fluorosis, what is that?
If you get too much fluoride, your teeth get kind of brown and mottled. So a little bit of fluoride protects against cavities. Too much, the teeth get this cosmetic blemishes, but that also makes people more likely to get cavities.
Well, did the committee also look at this idea that too much fluoride leads to increased broken bones?
This is the other thing. An idea that's been floating around for 10 or 15 years is that fluoride supplementation might actually prevent against fractures, because fluoride, the same way it's taken up into the teeth, is taken up into the bones. But the studies have been kind of coming out in recent years, and it turns out that fluoride supplementation actually makes the bones brittle. So the thinking is a long lifetime exposure to high levels of fluoride puts especially older people at higher risk of broken bones. So that's another reason that the committee said this upper limit for fluoride needs to come down.
And tell us, just kind of hop around the country, where is this upper limit used?
Most parts of the country have low fluoride levels. In New England, it's very low, and all the fluoride that we have is added to the water. But a few places, Texas is one, in the Southwest, New Mexico, Colorado, have higher levels. There are about 200,000 Americans who live in communities where the level's above this, you know, current 4 milligram per liter standard. And another 1.5 million Americans live in communities where the natural fluoride is kind of between 2 and 4 parts per million. So they're sort of in a gray zone.
Well, as you well know, Alan, there are people who don't want any fluoride in their water. But what has the EPA said to this criticism?
Well, the EPA actually commissioned this review, so presumably they will act upon it. The commissioners yesterday said the level has to come down. They didn't say how much it has to come down. So the EPA's job now is to start a new process to figure out what that level should be.
Okay. Well, while we're on the subject of fluoride, the committee also considered a controversial study from Harvard. What does that study say?
This is a small, not yet published study, which seems to link fluoride exposure with a rare type of bone cancer called osteosarcoma. The study looked at not these high levels of fluoride that we've been talking about, but in fact, very low levels, kind of a moderate level, and then the level which is the recommended level, about the one part per million level. And the researcher on that was a doctoral student at the Harvard Dental School named Elise Bassin.
We found that compared to patients with the lowest level of fluoride in their water, boys exposed to the moderate and high levels of fluoride had substantially higher risks of developing osteosarcoma.
And this was, of course, high, but within the accepted, supposedly accepted range of fluoride. So what does the National Research Council Committee say about that Harvard study?
This is interesting. Because it hasn't been published, this is sort of our first outside look at these results. They said they were preliminary and tentative, but they didn't completely discount the possibility. They said fluoride is taken up in bone, so this makes a certain biological sense. They said more studies needed. It's not proved yet.
Well, finally, Alan, what are dentists saying about fluoride? You know, they're out on the front lines of the whole issue.
Let's hear from a dentist named Myron Aloukian, who was key in this state, in Massachusetts, in getting fluoride into the water in the 1970s when water fluoridation began here. He, over the years, has seen the fluoride scares come and go. He thinks this is one more.
Hundreds of studies done by hundreds of different investigators, all the weight of the evidence is in the same direction. Community water fluoridation at the recommended level is safe, it's cost-effective, and it's practical.
Dentist Myron Aloukian, he was speaking with Here Now's Alan Cockle, who's been telling us about this new report from the National Research Council on Fluoride. Alan, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
And for more on the story, visit our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now.
Thank You for Smoking, the satirical novel by former Washington, D.C. speechwriter Christopher Buckley, won rave reviews when it hit the shelves in 1994, and now it's a movie. 28-year-old Jason Reitman wrote the screenplay and directed the film. Actor Aaron Eckhart plays Nick Naylor, the good-looking, morally flexible chief spokesperson for Big Tobacco. Here he is on the fictional Joan London show, sitting next to a boy with lung cancer.
How on earth would Big Tobacco profit off of the loss of this young man? Now, I hate to think in such callous terms, but if anything, we'd be losing a customer. It's not only our hope, it's in our best interest to keep Robin alive and smoking.
That's ludicrous.
Let me tell you something, Joan, and please.
Well, here now's Andrea Shea explains why actor Aaron Eckhart was the perfect get for this most villainous role.
Nick Naylor is a seductive bulldog. The narrator in Christopher Buckley's novel compares the tobacco lobbyist to Satan. And while Naylor has no horns or tail, his eyes are described as vibrantly pimpy. Early in the book, he convinces the audience at the Clean Lungs 2000 conference that smoking is an inalienable right, on par with the pursuit of happiness, regardless of how many lives it takes each year. Thank You for Smoking is a vicious diatribe on politics and the art of spin. When aspiring filmmaker Jason Reitman read it, he says it was love at first sight.
It was a book that didn't apologize for itself, and that was something I really just ate up and wanted to adapt into a movie.
And he did, with Buckley's input and blessing. Once the script was done, though, Reitman says the film's future hinged on casting the perfect Nick Naylor, a character who, like the book, doesn't apologize for himself or his questionable behavior.
The truth is that Nick sees his job as necessary and almost, dare I say, noble. The same way that a murderer needs a public defender, these big corporations, which are being constantly vilified, need someone like Nick to speak up for them. He's almost their white knight.
Actor Aaron Eckhart turned out to be Reitman's white knight when he agreed to play the nimble lobbyist in Thank You for Smoking. Here's Eckhart as Naylor arguing against William H. Macy's character, a self-righteous New England senator who's fighting to put a skull and crossbones on every pack of cigarettes.
Oh, this from a senator who calls Vermont home.
I don't follow you, Mr. Naylor.
Well, the real demonstrated number one killer in America is cholesterol. And here comes Senator Finister, whose fine state is, I regret to say, clogging the nation's arteries with Vermont cheddar cheese. If we want to talk numbers, how about the millions of people dying of heart attacks? Perhaps Vermont cheddar should come with a skull and crossbones.
Eckhart is no stranger to taking on politically incorrect roles. In fact, that's how he broke into the business. Eckhart debuted in writer and director Neil LaBute's notoriously wicked 1997 film, In the Company of Men. In it, Eckhart played Chad, a handsome, cunning corporate climber who conspires with a friend to romance, then dump, a lonely, deaf secretary, simply because he can.
We just do it, you know, you and me, up in the ante all the time. And suddenly she's got two men. She's calling her mom. She's wearing makeup again. And on we play, and on and on. And then one day, out goes a rug, and us pulling it hard. And Jill, she just comes tumbling after.
Whoa.
Hour later, we're on a flight back to civilization like nothing ever happened. Trust me, she'll be reaching for the sleeping pills within a week. And we will laugh about this till we are very old men.
In the Company of Men won praise, but it also raised hackles because of its shocking plotline and misogynist characters. Reitman says Eckhart's performance and LaBute's protagonist made a long-lasting impression.
When I saw In the Company of Men, I mean, it was startling. He created a type of character, which is a very difficult thing to do, you know, which is actually 10 years ago now, but I think still represents the closest thing to what we want to see Aaron Eckhart do, which is be incredibly subversive and simultaneously charming, which he has a knack for. Not a lot of guys can do that, and I don't know how he does that. I mean, I think it's something he was just born with. He can say these things, and you love him, and it goes beyond the fact that he's handsome. He has this indescribable quality to him that makes you just find him kind of likable and sexy, and, you know, that's obviously what led me to believe he'd be the perfect guy for my film.
Like Reitman, pop culture critic Rene Graham remembers Eckhart's breakthrough role vividly. And while he's gone on to play nice guys, such as the biker boyfriend in Erin Brockovich, Graham says Eckhart as Chad was almost too convincing.
That was a really indelible moment that I think is overlooked. I think it's one of the great underrated performances of the last decade or so. It took me a long time to remember, like, he's an actor. That's what he does. That's not who he is.
Graham says Eckhart's ability to transform himself is undeniable. Part of the reason he plays bad men so well, she says, has to do with his all-American golden boy appeal.
And it allows him to get away with murder in roles because he's got that dimple in the chin, he's got that blonde hair, he's got that great smile. And it just allows him to really be a pig. A lot of the time.
I just say the words. That's what I'll say in my defense.
Actor Aaron Eckhart says he's always looking for well-written words to say, even if the characters who utter them come across as cruel and heartless. In The Company of Men and Thank You for Smoking are unflinching satires of corporate America and political America. In both, Eckhart says he was just doing his job.
I just like to get up there and act. And I'm not concerned about people having visceral reactions. I consider that to be a compliment. I think it's good to make people feel, and I think that's what art is all about, whether you believe politically in what the film says or, you know, socially in terms of The Company of Men. I think that it's a good thing that we're challenging people's beliefs.
Eckhart adds that really compelling characters, no matter how evil they seem from the outside, stick with us because they're complex.
I don't know one single person on this earth who is all good or all bad. And the great thing about a great character is that he is able to invoke all of the feelings that a human being has and get them on the screen. And that's why audiences love those performances.
That said, Eckhart acknowledges a major difference between Chad in LeBute's film and Nick Naylor in Thank You for Smoking.
Chad was out-and-out malevolent. Nick Naylor is just doing his job.
And he does it well, perhaps too well, and with a little more zeal than some audiences might want to stomach. In this scene, Naylor one-ups the lobbyist for the alcohol industry.
Look, I mean, nothing personal, but tobacco generates a little more heat than alcohol.
Oh, this is news.
Well, my product puts away 475,000 a year.
Oh, okay, now 475 is a legit number.
Okay, 435,000, that's 1,200 a day. How many alcohol-related deaths a year?
Well,
100,000? Tops? Well, that's what, 270 a day? Wowee. 270 people, a tragedy. Excuse me if I don't exactly see terrorists getting excited about kidnapping anyone from the alcohol industry.
What Director Jason Reitman says getting Aaron Eckhart to play Nick Naylor was a major coup because he got the character, who, by the way, isn't all bad. But there's a certain irony in the fact that Naylor's headstrong qualities, the same ones that made Reitman fall in love with Thank You for Smoking in the first place, created obstacles to getting the film made in liberal Hollywood.
He never has a huge change of heart. He doesn't go work for the Red Cross in the third act. He's a lobbyist at the end of the movie, just as he is at the beginning. And most studios said, we'd consider making this movie if you would rewrite the third act. And I was not up for that. I wanted my movie to have a backbone, and I wanted it to be unique.
Unique, of course, can be a tough sell, says Reitman, especially when talking about a movie that jokes about lung cancer. But with a $5 million price tag, the young director says his independent, low-budget debut feature doesn't need to apologize for itself, either.
Smoke, smoke, smoke that cigarette. Puff, 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 and if you smoke yourself to death.
Tell St. Peter at the Golden Gate that you hate to make him wait, but you just gotta have another cigarette.
That story from Here and Now's Andrea Shea. Thank You for Smoking opens in select cities tomorrow. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Old Dame Fortune was doing me right. The kings and queens just kept on coming round. Well, I played them hard and I bet them high, but my bluff didn't work on a certain guy.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.